From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. More than 2,500 inmates in America's prison system are serving life terms for crimes they committed as juveniles. We'll explore whether society is served by sentencing youth to life in prison through the story of one Tampa-area man. He faced four back-to-back life sentences for his role in a string of robberies committed when he was 14 and 15 years old. His story is the subject of the POV documentary 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, premiering in August on PBS. Plus, it's been just over 4 years since the well was capped in the Deepwater Horizon spill, which discharged an estimated 4.9 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. We'll hear from researchers fresh from an expedition documenting the ongoing impacts to marine wildlife and the Gulf ecosystem. We'll also explore environmental restoration efforts from a legal and policy perspective. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. It's been 4 years since the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 people died, and some 210 million gallons of oil spilled into the Gulf, resulting in the largest man-made environmental disaster in U.S. history. Later this hour, we'll hear from researchers with Ocean Alliance working to document ongoing impacts of the spill on the Gulf ecosystem and marine life, along with details of environmental restoration efforts. But first, is society served by the practice of sentencing juveniles to life in prison without parole? The U.S. is the only country in the world where the practice is common. Currently, more than 2,500 inmates in America's prison system are serving life terms for crimes committed in their youth. More than 100 of these inmates were given the possibility of having their sentences reviewed following the U.S. Supreme Court's 2010 ruling in the case of Graham v. Florida, in which justices ruled that life in prison for juveniles convicted of crimes other than murder is unconstitutional. These facts serve as the backdrop for the POV, or point of view, documentary 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, which premieres next month on PBS. The film documents the story of Kenneth Young, a Tampa-area man sentenced to four back-to-back life terms for his role in a string of robberies committed when he was 14 and 15 years old with his mother's then 24-year-old crack dealer. Joining me now for a closer look at the case and other revelations about our justice system is the director and producer of the film, award-winning documentary filmmaker Nadine Pequeniza. In addition to 15 to Life, Pequeniza has produced the documentaries Inside Disaster Haiti, Aristides Haiti, and Raising Cassidy. Her work has been showcased at film festivals around the world. Nadine, thanks for joining us, and welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hello, John. Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
And to our listeners, what do you think about the practice of sentencing juveniles to life without parole? Connect with us by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments and questions on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. First of all, Nadine, tell us what inspired you to create this documentary. What came first for you? Was it this subject of committing people to life in prison without parole for crimes committed as youth, or was it Kenneth Young's story that first appeared on your radar?
No, it was a subject that attracted my attention because it's such an unusual practice when you look at international law and what's happening in other countries. It really caught my attention, and I read a book called No Choir Boy, which actually documented five cases of children who'd been sentenced to death, because up until 2005, children were eligible to be sentenced to death in the United States, but the U.S. Supreme Court banned that in 2005. So it was the issue, really, that attracted my attention. And then when I started to do a bit of research and found out about the U.S. Supreme Court decision, the Graham v. Florida decision in 2010, which you mentioned in your introduction, which made life without parole sentences for children who hadn't committed a homicide unconstitutional, that's when I thought there was an avenue to follow the reviews that would come out of that Supreme Court decision, because as a result of that, all of those sentences, and there were 128 children in the United States who received that sentence, all of them became illegal. And so those children, now many of them young adults, had to be looked at in either a parole hearing or in a resentencing hearing, which was the case of Florida because parole doesn't exist in Florida.
What do you think it indicates that of those 128 inmates who the Graham v. Florida gave the possibility of another chance, 77 of them were in Florida alone? Were you surprised by that number?
I was surprised. It's one of the reasons that I chose to focus on a case from Florida. It was children were 19 times more likely to be sentenced to life without parole for a non-homicide case in Florida. I mean, it's quite an extreme difference. And even now, the state of Florida transfers more children into the adult court system than any other state in the country. And there are reasons for that in terms of the process of how it happens. I don't know if you wanted me to get into that about direct file. It's basically a prosecutorial decision to decide whether children should be transferred into adult court, and that's where they face these kinds of sentences. In most states, the most common method for transferring a child from the juvenile court system into the adult is something called a judicial waiver, wherein both the prosecutor and the defense will be able to make a presentation to the judge, and it is up to the judge to decide whether the child is transferred. So I think that's one of the reasons that so many children in the within Florida have received this sentence, why the numbers are so skewed. The other thing to look at is within this subset of children, the 77 in Florida, 83% of them are African American. And so I think there's a legacy of the history that's happened in Florida with slavery and lynchings that carries through to the justice system today. You see the racial disparity in the children who are getting these sentences.
Well, I wanted to play an audio clip now from the documentary 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, courtesy of American Documentary POV. And in this audio, we'll hear from Pinellas County Sheriff's Office Chief George Steffen talking about the string of robberies that Kenneth Young was involved in.
We had a series of robberies in the Tampa Bay region. It was very violent. Over the counter, very vocal, in your face, guns to the head, putting people down on the ground. Our victims told us in all of these robberies that the most vocal one was Bethea. He was the older of the two. He was the one with the firearm. I'm not sure if Kenneth Young knew the consequences, quite frankly, at the time. But I, at that age, they really don't.
And as Chief Steffen just alluded to, and as it's been said regarding the impetus behind the Supreme Court's Graham v. Young ruling, kids are different. Nadine, what does that mean? Why did justices rule that juveniles are inherently different from adult offenders?
Well, actually, it has a lot to do with the brain science research that's been coming out. Even though it's something that, you know, parents and anyone who has a relationship with a child sort of knows intuitively, that children, they don't assess situations in the same way that adults do. They don't really understand time, you know, the passage of time, what 1 year compared to a lifetime can mean. They don't understand consequences. They don't have the same intellectual capacity. So their ability to reason, I mean, all of these things make children very different from adults, and that was the basis for, there have been three U.S. Supreme Court decisions now which have said that children are different. And so it goes back to the Roper decision that banned the death penalty, the Graham decision, which affected Kenneth. And then after that, 2 years later in 2012, there was a third decision, the Miller v. Alabama decision, which banned mandatory life sentences for juveniles for any crime they commit. That doesn't mean a child can't be sentenced to life. They still can be, but there has to be a possibility for release. And what the U.S. Supreme Court has said in these three decisions is a possibility for release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. And so along with these Supreme Court decisions, yes, children are different, not only in their ability in their culpability, their ability to be culpable for these crimes, but also in their ability for rehabilitation. Children have a greater chance at rehabilitation because they are younger, because they are not fully formed. And so the basis for these Supreme Court decisions has been that, and it's actually led to legislative reform in states across the country. Since these U.S. Supreme Court decisions, six states have banned the use of juvenile life without parole, and five other states have limited its use. Florida, just this past April, passed legislation allowing for a review process for children who face life sentences. So it is changing slowly how the courts deal with juveniles who commit serious crimes in the justice system, because I didn't want to, lessen or minimize the crimes that Kenneth committed. And I think it's important that they be dealt with seriously and there be consequences, but there has to be an opportunity for rehabilitation and reintegration with society.
We're talking with Nadine Pequeniza, the director and producer of the POV documentary film 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, ahead of its PBS premiere in August. We're discussing the practice of sentencing people to life in prison without parole for crimes committed as juveniles through the lens of one young Tampa man's story. Join our conversation with your phone calls to 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live, or post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Nadine, I wanted to play another audio clip from the documentary 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, courtesy of POV. And in this audio, we'll hear Kenneth Young himself in his own words describing a bit about his upbringing.
I stayed in like a low-income area. That's the environment I was brought up in, low income, you know, so drug dealings and, you know, robberies occur. You have all type of stuff, just low income area. Everybody trying to, like, do what they do. Sometimes mama locked me and my sister in the room and she just be gone. I'd be on my bicycle, and I already know, like, 9 times out of 10 where she'd be at getting high, because in my neighborhood, you have, like, certain apartments, certain houses that people go to get high. And I get on my bicycle, and I try to pull her from around there, tell her come home, take a shower, eat, stuff like that, you know.
That's Kenneth Young from Tampa in the documentary 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, a POV documentary airing next month on PBS. It was produced by our guest, Nadine Pequeniza. Nadine, from your time speaking with Kenneth, his family members, his attorneys, what other insights can you provide regarding Kenneth's childhood? And tell us about the events that led up to his involvement in that string of robberies with his mother's drug dealer, Jacques Bethea.
Kenneth, as he described, grew up in a very rough neighborhood. It's a neighborhood nicknamed Suitcase City because of the transient population there, the high rate of poverty and unemployment. 1 in 5 children in that zip code live below the poverty line. Kenneth's father died when he was still a toddler, so he was raised by a single mother who was dealing with a crack addiction. And so Kenneth was often left alone at home from the time he was a toddler all the way through to 14 when he was got involved in these crimes with Jacques Bethea and was arrested. Now, Kenneth maintains that the reason he started participating in these crimes is because Jacques Bethea told him that his mother owed him a drug debt for having stolen some drugs from Bethea. And so Kenneth maintains that he was coerced into participating, helping with these crimes in order to repay that debt at the threat of his mother being harmed. And George Steffen, the detective that we heard from earlier, does testify in Kenneth's resentencing that at the time of his arrest, Kenneth told him that Bethea had threatened to shoot him in one of the robberies. And so this story of intimidation is consistent with what Kenneth was reporting when he was 15 years old and what he was saying at age 26 during the resentencing hearing. And that's not uncommon for many of the kids who are in this situation. One of the reasons I chose Kenneth's case was because, yes, the sentence was extreme, 4 consecutive life sentences for armed robberies in which nobody was injured, but also because it is very representative of the cases out there. So 70% of kids who commit crimes that lead to a life without parole sentences commit those crimes with an adult. So they are either under the direction of an adult or being influenced by an adult. They're also predominantly kids of color, and they also, most of them, come from homes or neighborhoods where they face the kind of challenges that Kenneth did. One of the people that I interviewed in the documentary, Brian Stevenson, who brought these court challenges to the U.S. Supreme Court, said that, you know, the kids that he works with, that clientele, are among the most victimized people in our society, that they, you know, have suffered sexual and physical abuse and neglect, abandonment, malnourishment, mental illness, with no help. And so in society, in our inability to give these kids what they need to support them, to give them some sort of mentorship, guidance, and even health care, has led to the commission of these crimes. And many of them, 60%, are first-time offenders. That means they don't have a juvenile or an adult record, and they get a juvenile life without parole sentence. And so it's our response. I mean, I think we have to start questioning our response to these children and what our responsibility to them is before they land in these situations.
I think it's also worth knowing that Bethea, the adult involved in these crimes with Kenneth, only received a single life term, while Kenneth received four back-to-back life terms. How on earth did that come about?
Well, actually, his lawyer, Paolo Anino, told me that it's quite common around the country for adults committing these crimes with children to get less severe sentences. He didn't really have an explanation for that. It's a hard thing to explain. In thinking about it, my view is that potentially judges see a child committing such egregious acts at such a young age that they consider them to be super predators, that myth that came about in the 90s. Where, you know, if a child can do this at age 14, 15, what will they become when they're adults? Potentially that's the reason for the harsher punishments, but I honestly don't have the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a step back for a minute and look at Kenneth's mother, Stephanie Young, who I know you spent quite a bit of time with. What were your impressions of Stephanie, and how is she doing now? Does she blame herself for what happened with her son?
I think Stephanie still struggles quite a bit with the role she played in Kenneth's life and what led to these crimes. I mean, certainly her association with Jacques Bethea introduced Kenneth to this man. I mean, he was known to the neighborhood, but I think the fact that his mother had some involvement with him made Kenneth more susceptible to being recruited to perform these crimes. She denies having stolen drugs from Bethea. Like, he may have thought that, but she denies having done that. So we've had lots of conversations like that, and I think that comes from her remorse and guilt about what happened to Kenneth and the role she played there. She is now clean and sober. She's still living in the North Tampa area, not in Suitcase City, but in North Tampa. She stays in contact with Kenneth, visits him as much as she can. For many years, Kenneth was in prisons that were quite a distance from Tampa, and so it's expensive for families to go and visit their family members that might be in prison 3-4 hours away across the state. But now he's closer. He's only an hour and a half from her home. So I know they're in regular contact by phone, through letters, and she visits when she can.
And there's a scene in the film where Stephanie takes the stand and reads a letter that Kenneth's attorney appeared to not want her to read. I was curious if you could tell us a little bit about what she said and why the attorney maybe didn't want her to read that letter on the stand.
Yeah, well, I think the attorney, Paolo Anino, was taken by surprise because in the preparation that they were doing for the resentencing hearing, they had prepped Stephanie with, you know, the types of questions that might be asked and how, you know, what she should do in terms of dealing with certain questions that might come from the prosecution and from her own defense counsel or her son's defense counsel. And so they were taken by surprise by the letter. They had no idea that she was going to do that, and it really disallowed them to follow their line of questioning and get the kind of information that they wanted before the court. So I think that was the reaction to the letter. I don't think that there was nothing in particular in the letter that Paolo Anino was reacting to, because he didn't know the contents of the letter or that it was going to be read in.
Okay. I mean, and throughout the process of creating this film, did you ever talk to or attempt to talk to Bethea, or did you just maybe feel like that necessarily wasn't germane to the story you were trying to tell?
No, I did. I did reach out to Bethea and wrote asking permission to interview him, and he did accept. Unfortunately, I was not able to interview him because he is in closed custody and is in and out of closed custody quite a bit in the Department of Corrections in Florida, which means he gets into trouble with the authorities and so is not allowed media interviews.
We're exploring the practice of sentencing juveniles to life in prison without parole through the lens of one Tampa man's story, as told through the POV documentary 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, premiering next month on PBS. We're talking with filmmaker Nadine Pequeniza. Join our conversation with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. You can post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And let's now listen to our final audio clip from the documentary. This is some powerful testimony from robbery victim Jennifer Norman about her experience with Bethea and Kenneth Young on June 5th of 2000 in Clearwater. Norman begins by telling how Bethea and Young walked in. Bethea jumped the counter and grabbed Jennifer Norman by her ponytail, pointed a gun at her head, and began demanding money. And the next minute or two of the program may not be appropriate for younger listeners.
He grabbed me by the back of my hair and stuck the gun to my head. He was saying, like, give me the money, right, with the gun to my head. So, of course, I opened the register. I don't know what got it in this man's head, where his mind turned from money to other things. But he started to say, like, I'm gonna rape this. You know, he just kept saying that over and over, you know, and then Kenneth was not in the room. He was still in the lobby. Like, he wasn't even behind the front desk. So Bethea kept saying that, and he came to the doorway, and he said, you can't do that. We have to leave. Bethea basically picked me up off the ground by my hair, and then he threw me on the floor and kicked me in my back, and then they left.
That was robbery victim Jennifer Norman describing what happened to her as part of the documentary 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story. Our guest is filmmaker Nadine Pequeniza. Nadine, do you think Kenneth's actions during that robbery may have saved Jennifer Norman by preventing Bethea from sexually assaulting her?
Definitely, that's what Jennifer thinks, and that's what she said in the documentary. She also said that she later wrote Kenneth in prison to let him know exactly what that incident had done to her, how it affected her life, and that she forgave him for what he had done. And I just want to clarify, because I know these clips are out of context. Yeah. Kenneth didn't touch Jennifer, never jumped over the counter, didn't have the gun. So by Jennifer Norman's account, Kenneth was always on the other side of the counter. It was Bethea who was the aggressor, and that's what Kenneth maintains was the scenario in all of the robberies. And Detective George Stephan of Pinellas County also said that in the victims that he interviewed, that was what he was being told was the general scenario of how things happened, you know, and who played what role in the robberies.
And in Kenneth's court proceedings following the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court decision that sort of allowed him to have that opportunity, did Jennifer Norman ever testify? We do hear from some of the other robbery victims.
No, unfortunately. Jennifer is Canadian, and she now lives in Alberta, Canada, and they were unable to get her down for the sentencing or the resentencing hearing. So unfortunately, she did not testify. I don't know if that would have changed things. At the time that Kenneth was resentenced, Florida had not yet passed legislation instructing judges on what they had to consider in the resentencing. And in fact, Kenneth's new sentence is under appeal is being appealed by him and his lawyers based on the fact that they're arguing the resentencing judge did not consider Kenneth's rehabilitation.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You had mentioned before that, you know, part of your inability to talk to Bethea was based on his poor behavior in prison. Kenneth, on the other hand, had a single infraction during the more than a decade that he'd already spent in prison at that time. Kenneth had gotten his GED, says he'd taken every opportunity to stay out of trouble by requesting to participate in as many programs as he can. Based on that, was rehabilitation demonstrated by Kenneth's attorneys?
Well, the infraction that you mentioned, John, was actually for not making his bed one morning. So it wasn't even a serious infraction, and he had a stellar record. He was a model prisoner, and the resentencing judge acknowledged that in 2011, but he didn't feel that that was cause for him being released at this time. Kenneth's lawyers were arguing for his release into a transition house, and of course there would have been probation with that, so it wouldn't be like he was released just into society without any supervision or assistance in reintegration. But the judge did acknowledge that Kenneth was rehabilitated.
And there seemed to be a pattern in the robberies of, you know, truly terrorizing these victims. I'm talking about Bethea, you know, putting guns to their heads, threatening to kill them, threatening them with sexual violence. We hear testimony from another victim, Sandra Christopher, in which she states she just wouldn't feel safe with Kenneth walking the streets again. Was your aim in creating this documentary to also put audience members in the shoes of the victims and not just Young's situation?
I wanted to represent both sides. As best I could, because I think this is a very contentious issue in society, and victims' rights are obviously very important, as are these children's rights. So I think we have to listen to all perspectives when we're having these discussions. So that was important to me. And I had hoped to interview Sandra Christopher outside of court, but unfortunately she declined to be interviewed. But yes, I wanted people to put themselves in both shoes.
And as we've mentioned, the 2010 Graham v. Florida Supreme Court decision is really what gave those 128 juvenile offenders, or at least juvenile at the time of their offenses, the ability to at least have their sentences looked at again. Among all those cases, why did you choose to focus on the case of Kenneth Young? What makes his case particularly exceptional for you?
Well, I thought Kenneth's case, the sentence that he received was exceptionally harsh, four consecutive life sentences for armed robbery, in which the gun was never fired, nobody was sent to hospital, there was no serious injury that came out of any of those crimes. So it was the harshness of the sentence, but it was also, as we were talking about earlier, that Kenneth is exemplary of many of the kids who end up in these circumstances, you know, coming from difficult childhoods where poverty, neglect, abuse are part of their history. And also he's African-American. A disproportionate number of African-American youth receive this sentence. They're 10 times more likely to get this sentence than their white peers. And also the fact that he was in Florida, and Florida's record with having 77 of the 128 juveniles sentenced to life without parole for a non-homicide crime. Those are the reasons that I decided to focus on Kenneth and Florida.
And I realize a great deal of time and interviews went into making this film that probably didn't necessarily make it into the final cut for an hour-long documentary. Was there any particular information or portions of interviews that you lament not having been able to make it into the final cut?
Yes, I'm very sorry to... I interviewed Ernest Young, who is Kenneth's older cousin. He's 13 years older than him. And he's actually, he works with the Tampa Tribune, which just did a profile of the case in the documentary. It was in the paper a couple of days ago. So if people are interested in learning more about Ernest. But when I interviewed him, he talked about being a father figure to Kenneth when he was growing up, and they were quite close. Kenneth used to come to him with problems because, you know, not having a father and with his mother struggling with a crack addiction, Kenneth needed that. And then, unfortunately, at the time Kenneth was turning 12, 13, Ernest started to have his own family. He got married. He had his own kids, and so less time for Kenneth. And unfortunately, that's when he started his relationship, or when he was approached by Jacques Bethea. So I'm sorry that I wasn't able to include that. And Ernest also grew up in the same neighborhood, so he understood what it was like for children there and the amount of drug dealing and crimes that were happening. And he himself had been involved in some problems when he was younger and managed to turn his life around. I think he's an example of what Kenneth could have been if he'd been given the opportunity.
And, you know, with the understanding that Kenneth's case is being appealed at the federal level, what is his sentence now? When could he potentially get out of jail if the federal appeal is denied?
2030 is his release date. So he would be 45 years old and... would have spent two-thirds of his life in prison by the time he would be released.
And Nadine, tell us what's next for you. Are you working on an upcoming documentary film that we can look forward to in the future?
I am. I'm working on a documentary about gun culture in Canada. So the situation in Canada is quite different in the United States, but we are right now repealing gun control legislation, which has made it... a topic of discussion here. And so that's what I'm working on now.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this portion of the show. I want to thank my guest, award-winning independent filmmaker Nadine Pequeniza. She directed and produced the documentary we've been talking about today, 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, which premieres on POV on PBS at 10 p.m. August 4th. The film premieres on WGCU-TV rather on Wednesday, August 6th at 4 a.m. and later that same day on WGCU World at 8 p.m. A full listing of the documentaries airing on WGCU-TV is available at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. It will also be available for web streaming at the POV website August 5th through September 4th. Nadine Pequeniza, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, John. It was a pleasure.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, it's been 4 years since the BP oil spill discharged 4.9 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. While many of the most visible signs of damage from America's largest man-made environmental disaster have dissipated, researchers continue to document ongoing impacts to the Gulf ecosystem and marine environment. We'll learn about some of those efforts and what they're finding, plus a look at the policy side of environmental restoration efforts. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.